Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. Members, we have a full day today. We want to try to finish up with the courts in the next hour. So, Mr. Stahl, I understand we're going to skip around here just a little bit and hold off on our discussion about guardian ad litems and go to interpreters. So I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to give you and the committee some better understanding of the significance of interpreters, I'd like to call on Judge Salvador Rosas of Ramsey County.
Good morning.
Judge, please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Salvador Rosas. I'm a judge here in Ramsey County. Members of this committee, I'd like for you to imagine yourselves on a trip to Latin America. You can't speak Spanish, and a vacation that was going so well has gone bad. You've been arrested. You've been detained by the police. You've been questioned, but you don't know what they're asking you. You don't know why you're being held. And after a couple of days in incarceration, you're brought into a courtroom, and you appear before somebody who looks a little like me. And this person begins to speak to you, and he says, ¿Cómo te llamas? ¿Tienes abogado? Usted tiene el derecho a un abogado en todos los procedimientos. Si usted no puede pagar los honorarios de un abogado, la corte le asignará uno. Usted tiene el derecho a un juicio por un jurado o un juicio por un juez. A usted no se requiere decir nada o someterse a interrogación. Cualquier cosa que diga puede ser usado en contra de usted en cualquier otro procedimiento. Now, as you can see, when you don't understand the language that's spoken in the court, in any type of case, civil, juvenile, criminal, on a case that involves an important matter to you, a matter like your property, custody of your children, your liberty, a lot depends on the availability and competency of qualified court interpreters. So let me say the same thing with the use of a certified interpreter now.
¿Cómo te llamas?
What is your name?
¿Tienes un abogado?
Do you have a lawyer?
Usted tiene el derecho a un abogado en todos los procedimientos.
You have a right to be represented by a lawyer in any proceeding.
Si usted no puede pagar los honorarios de un abogado, la corte le asignará uno.
If you cannot afford a lawyer, the court will appoint one to you.
Usted tiene el derecho a un juicio por un jurado o un juicio por un juez.
You have the right to a trial by judge or by jury.
Cualquier cosa que diga puede ser usado en contra de usted.
Anything you say may be used against you.
The members of the committee, a few years ago, I testified here with the same message, asking for support for court interpreters. Since then, the need has not diminished. As a matter of fact, a significant increase in the size of Minnesota's non-English speaking population has resulted in increased demands on our courts to meet the needs and protect the rights of persons handicapped by language. Interpreters are crucial components of our system of justice. And if you are concerned, as I am, about ensuring the rights of all people who appear in our courts, that their rights are protected, you must provide the necessary resources for court interpreters to ensure equal justice for all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members, as Judge Rosas has indicated, this is a legislative policy of this state that the rights of individuals handicapped in communication cannot be fully protected without the aid of a qualified interpreter. And this is because at bottom there can be no justice without comprehension. Now, you can see that the growth in the non-English speaking population has increased steadily each year. And in fact, Minnesota ranked second only to California in 2005 in the number of refugee arrivals. And of course, these changing demographics are resulting in some 73 different languages on our interpreter roster, 33,000 hearings per year, 133 every single day. And this is definitely not just a metro issue. This is a statewide issue. And this example of Worthington, where one in five hearings are in another language. And in fact, I talked to Judge Jeff Flynn there recently, and they have as many as three different languages in one case in Worthington. So it's not just Spanish, whereas the this is gives you some sense for the diversity of the languages that we use regularly. And the cost of interpreters as a result of this increased demand, of course, is increasing, and there's been no new funding since 2003, but we have experienced a 29% increase in the demand for interpreters. And so this is the basis on which we are requesting $606,000 in the first year and $777,000 in the second year to meet these constitutionally and statutorily required services. So that would be that plus, Mr. Chair.
Please continue, Mr. Sell.
The next area of legally mandated services is psychological services. By court statute, the courts are required to pay for psychological examinations for Rule 20 competency exams in criminal cases, as well as for examinations in civil commitment cases. Highly skilled, licensed psychologists and psychiatrists are required for these examinations, and we see a continued increase in cost due to the increasing filings, the complexity of these examinations, and increased hourly rates. Again, no new money has been provided for this area since 2003, but yet we've had this remarkable 58% increase in expenditures. And the reason is, and the case drivers here are the increasing criminal cases that we're seeing, increased commitment cases, but by far and away the largest impact on the increased cost here are the increased costs and resulting from the rise in filings and the matters dealing with sexually psychopathic personality and sexual dangerous persons cases coming from that change in the Department of Corrections policy since 2003, referring much greater numbers of level 3 sex offenders for possible civil commitment. And each of these cases are ranging from $8,000 to $15,000 for these psychological exams. So you can imagine the cost pressures that this is creating. And it is on that basis that we are requesting about $3.6 million for the biennium to deal with these costs over which we have no control, the most important cases that come before us that need to be taken care of. These are absolutely essential portions of moving those cases along.
Mr. Dodge, on the last two items for interpreters and psychological services, are cases being delayed because of the lack of services?
Mr. Chair, we are trying to pull these through Band-Aids right now, through one-time monies that we have to provide for that. So I would say that for the most part, cases are not delayed. In the interpreter area, depending on the nature of the language, it may be difficult to find the right person, and so there may be some delays as a result of that. But we are, you know, just trying to pull together and with Band-Aids what it is that we need to fund these services, and we are not able to do that with a base budget that we have, and that's why we're requesting these funds.
Well, I'm just trying to get at how serious the problem is. I understand how much money you want, but if you're not experiencing delays now, why are you projecting the amounts that you are for both services?
Because these are one-time funds that we have been able to scrape together, and we're not going to have them going forward in the next biennium, given the cost pressures with personnel costs and that kind of thing. That will not be available. And then we are going to see the kinds of delays that you're talking about if we don't get that funding.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rosal, you said it cost like $8,000 for one evaluation. I mean, I guess I'm just having trouble understanding how it can cost that much to do an evaluation. You said hourly rates are, I mean, maybe my math is wrong here, but if it's $200 an hour, that's 40 hours to do one evaluation. I mean, it's just something doesn't add up right. I can't understand that.
If I could, I'd like to call on Dr. Lawrence Pansiera from Hennepin County, who is an individual that does these exams himself. And
sir, would you introduce yourself to the record?
Yeah, Lawrence Pansiera from District Court Psychological Services in Hennepin County. The particular exams we're talking about now are the SDP-SPP examinations.
Sir, would you tell us what that is?
Yes, the sexually psychopathic personality and the sexually dangerous person evaluations.
Thank you.
These are quite different than other evaluations. Typically, evaluations of the other sorts, Rule 20s, cost maybe $1,000, give or take. But these are extraordinary because, first of all, the examiner has to review what often comes in two or three boxes of prior records. The examiner has to also interview the person over sometimes 3 or 4 hours, do psychological testing, and then there are testimony costs that are wrapped into this. And these are very highly contested hearings where there can take several days, and I've known of examiners on the stand for over a day in cross-examination. So that's the reason why these particular kinds of evaluations or costs for the examiners are relatively speaking very high. On a national level, I don't think they are that high. I mean, these are big cases in every state, and I know that in other states the examiner costs per case are even higher. But that's the reason why they're so expensive.
Representative Eastland.
Then maybe I could ask, if these are kind of extraordinary costs for extraordinary cases, is the $8,000 number a fair number to use when we talk about just these psychological services and evaluations in general? In general, what do they cost, and what percentage of the cases run into this kind of a cost category?
Mr. Pansiera?
I think that Mr. Sal indicated there were, 170 of these over the state. Because of the way the law is written and because of the importance of the case, invariably there are two examiners in every case. So we're talking about roughly 350 examinations per year at that cost. That'll give for that kind of exam. The other exams vary from state or from county to county depending on the availability of examiners. I think that Rule 20 evaluations can be conducted, depending on the complexity of the case, between $800 and $1,500 per examination. Civil commitment evaluations, depending on how it's conducted in a county, could vary from a couple of $100 to $1,000. So there's a lot of variation from county to county depending on availability of examiners and the way in which the whole procedure is conducted in the courts.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, just to give you some idea, in 2002 there were 14 of these referrals for possible civil commitment by the Department of Corrections, and as was indicated, it's running somewhere between 120 and 175. I think last year was 175. So when you talk, these are those sexually dangerous persons cases, and that's why the significant part of this increase is coming directly from that. There is some general increase in civil commitment cases, about 18% over this time period, and also in the criminal cases that relate to this, about 15%. So some of it is just a natural increase, but by far the biggest impact is this surge in these very expensive cases.
Can I have one more?
Representative Eastman.
Is there any professional, since these are high-profile, high-risk kind of cases, what is the professional liability that falls back on the people doing the examinations here?
Mr. Pansiera.
I'm not sure how to answer that question. To my knowledge, there's never been there may have been board complaints. I don't know. That's one of the options that a person complained to the board saying an examiner didn't do a proper job. I don't think there's ever been any kind of a resulting lawsuit. So practically speaking, I don't know you know, what has was that occurred. We do require all examiners to carry malpractice insurance as part of their conducting these examinations.
Representative Olin.
Just a follow-up from Representative Eastland's questions. And I think Ms. Dossel probably can answer this one. When we speak of these cases, greater Minnesota cases have increased immensely. Along with that, the charges for these experts usually happen portal to portal, so the charge just isn't necessarily just in Pennington County, 5 hours away. Is that correct?
Mr. Pence, yeah.
In those counties on the outside where there are few examiners available, they tend to work primarily in urban areas. They charge what they charge, and there's the court has, in those cases, relatively little option but to pay traveling fee, and sometimes they do end up paying their hourly rate for the car ride to and from.
Senator Nolan?
No follow-ups.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pencier, for your testimony. Mrs. Zell, you want to continue?
Mr. Chair and members, the last in this area of mandated services is a request for $178,000 each year for informa pauperis costs. And these are costs for service of process, for publication, copying, and transcript costs for non-criminal cases and litigants who cannot afford this. This is required by statute. And these costs are just, again, naturally increasing.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on now to our third large category of requests. This is for judgeships to meet the increasing caseload growth that we are experiencing. Now, as I've indicated before, we have about 2 million cases that we handle each year. Of those, about 223,000 we consider to be major cases. These would be felonies and gross misdemeanors, civil family probate, and juvenile. And even though these major cases account for only 11% of our filings, they take up the vast bulk of our judges' time. These major cases have been growing in the last decade, about 17%, but by far and away, the fastest growth area is in the criminal area. Felonies and gross misdemeanors have increased by 54%, and our trial judges now are handling about 25,000 more of these cases than they did 10 years ago. We have about 64,000 of these major cases, felonies and gross misdemeanors. About half of them are felonies, and the other half are gross misdemeanors. And in just this five-year period, felonies have increased by 44% and gross misdemeanors by 24%. So you can see the pressures that are happening in our trial courts. Now, what's been the impact? Well, this tremendous growth in criminal cases over the last decade has put such stress on the system without adequate resources that backlogs and delays are beginning to happen. By statute and by court policy, we have adopted essentially the American Bar Association standards for case processing time. And our expectation is that 90% of our felonies and gross misdemeanors should be completed within 4 months, 97% within 6 months, and nearly all, 99% within 1 year. And you can see on the bar on the right-hand side that we are not coming close to meeting those standards. Now, this is important because justice delayed is justice denied, and surely that is the case. But it is also important because this undermines deterrence. What has been empirically shown is that the largest single factor in reducing recidivism is the closeness in time, the swiftness in time between the criminal offense and the imposition of a judicial sanction. Much more important than the nature of the penalty, the kind of the penalty, or the length of incarceration. So this is a very important part of this overall puzzle. We heard testimony yesterday about drug courts and that same kind of principle rang true with them, and I think it does when you just think of that yourself. So.
Mr. Sally, I have a question. Yes. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, to this graph itself, I just want to make sure that I understand it. On the objective side, is that for all cases that come before the court, and then on the major criminal, you've pulled that out individually?
This objective is actually for criminal cases, for felonies and gross misdemeanors. Okay. We have a different standard for civil cases and family cases and juvenile cases, but this is the standard, which is by statute a standard, and also by court policy our standard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, since 1980, we have used the weighted caseload analysis as the basis for determining objectively how many judges we need in Minnesota. And the weighted caseload is based on a comprehensive time and motion study of our judges for a 9-week period, all judges. We determine how much time on average it takes to dispose of 49 different types of cases. And then we take that time or those weights and we multiply that times the different mix of cases that we have in each of our 87 counties, and that is how we determine how many judges we need in the state and in what locations. Now, based on those that weighted caseload analysis and using the filings for the end of the year 2005, which is the last full year before we put our budget into the system, we are requesting 9 new judgeships. If we were to take the increased filings that have occurred in 2006, we actually would be needing 14 judges. But we are asking for the 9 judges. Judgeships, they are located as indicated in this slide, and I think it's interesting to see that they're all over the state, and none of them are in the metro area. There's not a judgeship being requested for either Hennepin or Ramsey County. The growth areas are in other parts of the state. So to give you a view from the trenches, we've asked Judge Bill Macklin, who is the chief judge of the 1st Judicial District, one of the very pressured districts, to talk a little bit about what life is like in the trial court.
Judge,
good morning.
Welcome to the committee. You want to introduce yourself for the record?
I do. I'm William Macklin, and I'm a district court judge chambered in Shakopee, Minnesota. And for the faces that I don't recognize, I used to sit on that side of the table for 10 years as a state representative from Dakota County and Scott County. And it's a little more intimidating to be on this side of the conference here. However, you have a very kind chair, and I always got along with him well, I hope.
Thank you, Jed.
I recall an occasion about 12 or 14 years ago on the Judiciary Finance Committee. That's what we called this committee back then. And Representative Murphy was the chair at that time. And we invited a panel of 7 judges to come down to the Capitol one evening and talk to us about their concerns and their issues regarding their work in the judiciary generally. And they had, every one of them had one thing in common. They were all former legislators. And it was a wide-ranging discussion, but in the end it focused on 2 things, increasing caseloads and the need for more judges. And that's the same message that I'm here to talk about today. Mine will be a little more anecdotal testimony based on my experience as a judge in the 1st District and as chief judge of the 1st Judicial District. Our district is comprised of 7 counties, 3 metropolitan counties, Dakota, Scott, and Carver. Dakota actually accounts for over half the population of the 1st Judicial District. As you know, and as Representative Biskins, who is my representative and represents a large part of Scott County, can tell you, these are rapidly growing counties. In fact, a couple years ago, Scott County was, I believe, the 9th fastest growing county in the United States. And with that growth comes a lot of issues, not the least of which is the need for more court time, more criminal activity, just generally the need for more judge time. In the 1st District, we have 33 judges, And according to the most current weighted caseload, as I understand it at least, we're down just about four judges in the first district. I work, as I said, in Scott County, and we have five judges in Scott County. Again, according to the latest weighted caseload, we're currently short 6.5 judges. That's what we would need to be able to, based on weighted caseload, to handle our work. Just to give you, to show you the type of growth that we're having in Scott County, if you look back at the, I believe, the 05 weighted caseload numbers, and then you compare that to the current numbers, just a year ago, we were down 5.5 judges. Now we're down 6.5 judges. Our caseload in Scott County is increasing at least 10% or more per year. We have in the criminal law area some of the impacts that I think are happening, and Ms. DeSalle has already talked about that, is the delays that we're experiencing in the criminal law area. We set our calendars on a daily basis, and we have a certain number, depending upon what kind of a criminal calendar is. It might be a pretrial calendar in misdemeanor cases. It might be a first appearance calendar in gross misdemeanor and felony cases, or omnibus hearings or trials. And we have a certain number based on norms that we like to have on our calendars so that we have time to adequately reflect and give attention to those cases. In Scott County, our calendars are constantly overbooked, and depending upon the calendar, it can be, in the last 6 months, it was anywhere from 17% to 71% overbooked, beyond the norms. The effects of that, the effects of the rising caseload and the effect of needing additional judges, I think, based upon my experience, is that we're seeing, first of all, the delays, especially in the criminal law area. If you come to Scott County representing a defendant in a gross misdemeanor or a felony case, even though the rules of criminal procedures suggest that you should have an omnibus hearing 28 days after your first appearance, we're setting omnibus hearings 3.5 to 4 months out just because we don't have the availability on our calendars. In pretrial hearings and misdemeanors, it's routinely 4 to 5 months out. Now, we do obviously give priority to defendants that are in custody, and if they are in custody, they routinely will ask for their hearing within 28 days, and we do accommodate that, but we accommodate it by overbooking the calendars. The other frustration I would say that most judges feel in counties where we need more judges is that there's just a lack of time to adequately reflect on the cases that you're handling, or even to give to the people that are appearing before you. Child protection cases are probably some of the most important work that we do. But if you have 10 or 12 child protection cases scheduled in a morning, you can do the math. In 3 hours, you just don't have a lot of time to give to each one of those cases. And I think, I believe that we do need to spend more time on child protection cases. We have a huge increase, I think, throughout the state in pro se litigants. That's people that are not represented by lawyers. And we try to do our best with them. We try to give them time to present their case, which is often not done in the most relevant manner. Family law cases, for example, where the parties are pro se, they're given a form that's probably 40, 50 pages long, which is their findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order for judgment, the final document in a divorce. In cases where litigants are represented by lawyers, we can be pretty confident that those findings and those conclusions will be accurate. But in the pro se case where they're checking boxes and writing in their own legal descriptions, it takes a lot more time for us to look at those, and I think we need to do it because, if, for example, if one of the parties is awarded the homestead and they say the legal description is as on the tax statement, or it's 111 Main Street. Well, that's not a legal description, and someday down the road they'll go to sell that piece of property and they'll have horrible title nightmares. So those are the things that we're looking for. I had submitted to me a set of findings, conclusions of law, and order for judgment. The findings were all filled out. Nothing else was filled out. So had I signed that, they would not have been divorced. There would have been no award of property. There would have been no award of custody. The last area I'd like to comment on is what we call our small claims court. When I was in the legislature back in the late 80s, early 90s, Andy Dawkins, some of you may remember Andy, and he pushed to increase the jurisdictional limits of conciliation court from, at the time, about a $1,000 case up to a $7,500 case. It's a good idea. I don't have any objection to the jurisdictional limit being pushed up, but these cases that we see are much more complicated than they used to be when they were $200 or $300 or $400 cases. They take more time. But if you have 15 of those contested cases on a morning calendar, it's very difficult to give the time to the litigants that they think they need. And yet, it's what we have to do. We have to direct them in ways that they probably feel that they're not being listened to. I guess one question that I'd have if I were on your side of the conference table is that, you know, so what if we don't give you any additional judges? What's the consequence going to be? I can assure you that there will be 300 district court judges that every morning will get up, they'll go to their courthouses, and they'll do their job to the best of their ability, which is what they agreed to do when they took the job. But my concern is that the long-term effects of operating without additional judges is that our delays will continue to increase. Judges won't have enough time to adequately reflect on the important issues that are before them, and that the public, in the end, is going to be shortchanged by the judicial system. I know that, having been a legislator, that there are many important issues on your plate. There are huge needs in K-12 funding, higher ed funding, transportation, property tax relief, and that this probably isn't the sexiest of issues, new judges. But I hope that in your deliberations this year, both here and as a legislature, that you will keep in mind that the judiciary is important and our constituents deserve a good service. Thank you.
Judge Macklin, thank you for your testimony, and welcome back to the Capitol.
Thank you. I almost got lost coming over.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know who might want to answer this, but we see these large increases in violent crime, and it would be interesting if you had a perspective as to why that might be occurring. And I'm a big believer in prevention, so in addition to funding courts appropriately, making certain that we stop them from happening. So any thoughts or suggestions as we move forward?
If anyone here at this table or in this room could give us the recipe for avoiding this criminal activity, it would be wonderful. We try to do a lot of things. We spend a lot of money on social services, a lot of money in the criminal justice system, and yet, as you can see, our caseloads keep increasing. I don't think it's just a reflection of population growth, but I think it's a reflection of other things that are happening in society. Mr. Sal?
Thank you. We have about 10 more minutes, Mr. Sal. Do you think you can wrap this up by then, or do you need more time?
I think we can try. We've got maybe 15 minutes.
Okay.
I'm sorry I thought so long.
It comes from being here, Judge. Representative Biskins, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, first a comment. The judge said this isn't a real sexy issue. Well, Judge, don't sell yourself short. You're doing all right. Mr. Chairman, I guess I do need to know, is there any precedent for the state looking at caseloads on a statewide basis and making determinations that judgeships to balance cases statewide, that there'd be some shifting of judgeships from one district over to another. I know not the actual judges, but the policy of, you know, as demographics shift throughout the state, of making those kinds of shifts.
Mr. Saul, do you want to take a crack at it? We have staff that could also.
Mr. Chair and Representative, in 1985, the legislature authorized, passed new legislation that gave the authority to the Supreme Court to determine every time there's a vacancy in a judgeship where that judgeship should be certified for filling. And we have used that authority, and particularly in the late 80s, to take judgeships out of the outstate area where the population had declined, and we put them all into the metro area. We now are seeing, as you can see here, where the outstate area is experiencing growth. So we use this weighted caseload every day, both internally within our districts and also to determine whether we should move judgeships around, and we do that when we need that. So this is, I think, is a good reflection of where they are needed.
So, Maury, a brief question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The brief question would be, what happened? I never saw you around here before without Representative Smith next to you. Ms. Dosell, he said that that they need six more according to the caseload. That would be 11 for Scott County, and that's, I think Hennepin only has about 55, and I'm wondering, it seems to me like if you look at the number of cases and the complexity of them, Hennepin would certainly need more than five times what Scott has. I would
judge.
I was wondering how you weight those cases or something.
Judge Matt?
Maybe I misspoke, but our total need is 6.5 judges. We have 5 now, so it would be an additional 1.5.
Oh.
Thank you, Judge Mathen, for your testimony. At this point, Mr. Sal, if you could just for one moment here, I need a motion to approve the minutes of January 6th, two meetings, the morning meeting and the joint hearing in the evening. Representative Bigham moves the minutes of June 6th and June 6th. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. I'd also like to announce that we have, we have partisan cookies. How can we get those? Jennifer's going to bring those out. We have DFL and GOP cookies and we have other. I guess those are independents for the people in the audience here. So for Valentine's Day, so happy Valentine's Day, and that's from Libby and Melanie, who brought the cookies, and this is a present from Legal Aid. I hope it's not more than $5 worth of value. We'll pass those on also. Okay, Mr. Salas, we can continue on. I'm hoping that we have a bill today too, and I was hoping we could get all of the, maybe I was, this is wishful thinking.
We'll try to move along, Mr. Chair. I'd like to call on Chief Judge Edward Toussaint now to speak to the judgeship need at the Court of Appeals.
Judge Toussaint, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Edward Toussaint, and since 1995 I've had the opportunity to preside as the Chief Judge of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Just as a review, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is a 16-member court. We sit in 3-judge panels. We hear cases throughout the state of Minnesota. We travel monthly, or rather sometimes weekly, to the jurisdictions wherein the cases arise. We will go from Duluth to Rochester, to Worthington, to Crookston, to Bemidji, to St. Cloud, and all other places in between. In fact, in April of 2005, I'm on a panel that's ultimately is going to go to Lyon County in Marshall, and we've never been to Marshall before. We hear cases from the trial courts, all cases with the exception of first-degree murder, which have a direct appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court. We also hear cases from state agencies, from city council decisions in regard to licensure, et cetera. And we hear cases from your county boards that determine whether they're going to have a conditional use permit, et cetera. Throughout all of those cases that we hear, we are living up to both our constitutional and our statutory requirement is to hear cases and to render decisions fairly, expeditiously, and according to the law.
Do you have the chart?
Okay. As you see by the chart that's on the screen, the Minnesota Court of Appeals, the number of appeals have gone up significantly since 1999. Those cases have gone up 18%. And you'll notice that it's on an upward trend. And our belief is that that trend will continue. We intend by this request to be able to resolve. In our request for funding, additional funding, we're looking at having an additional panel to be able to more expeditiously resolve the issues that come before us. Right now, as we sit today, we have about 550 cases that are pending that are capable of being set for hearing, but with no calendar for them to be set on. And this is an increasing number of cases. For us, this increasing number of cases, we have attempted to resolve this continuing backlog, but all of our attempts have not significantly impacted the increase in that number. Previously, well, prior to 1999, we were able to set our cases on for hearing within 35 to 45 days from the time the cases are ready to be heard. Now, our cases are being heard 180 days, or actually 6 months, from the time that they are ready to be heard. So the Sala talked about the ABA standards as guiding us as to how we determine our timeliness. For the Court of Appeals, the ABA standards is 55 days from the time the case is ready to be heard and the actual case being heard. You can see the significant change from our court beginning in 1999 until the present day. And so we are presently not meeting that ABA standard. It is our request that the number of an additional panel will resolve approximately 280 more cases per year. In the initial discussion by Ms. LaSalle, she talked about justice delayed is justice denied. And I thought I would try to put those in three cases to give you an example of what that really means. And it's really three different cases that ultimately show the impact on not rendering decisions timely and expeditiously. The first case is a juvenile case. We have an extended juvenile jurisdiction. This is a case that happened in St. Cloud near McDonald's. There was an issue in regard to brandishing of weapons by CDS, who is the juvenile. At the trial, CDS's attorney failed to make some objections in regard to the admissibility of some evidence, eyewitness identification, and then a lack of some jury instructions to the judge. That case was ultimately appealed to our court, and the case was ready for briefing in June of 2006. We were unable to hear that case until December of 2006. We ultimately, that panel, once the case was heard, decided that they were going to expedite the delivery of that opinion, and that opinion was rendered in January of 2007. And I bring this case to your attention because we reversed and remanded that case for a new trial because of ineffective assistance of counsel. And all this time, the juvenile has been in custody, and as far as I know, the juvenile is still in custody awaiting a new trial. The second case is the case that I'm sure that most of you might know about. In August 2005, Northwest Airlines imposed 25% of pay cuts for its union workers who worked as cleaners and custodians, and those who worked as technicians and inspectors. More than 1,600 workers filed for unemployment benefits during the resulting strike and life lockout. The Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development determined that the cleaner custodians were entitled to the benefits, but not the technicians and the inspectors. Northwest Airlines appealed, and those who were denied benefits also ultimately appealed. This was in October of 2005. The case was ready for scheduling for a hearing in February of 2006. The actual hearing was in June of 2008, and we ultimately issued our decision in September of 2006. The Minnesota Supreme Court denied additional review on October of 2006. So ultimately, between August of 2005 and October of 2006, those individuals who were entitled to benefits were not receiving those. And then finally, this is one of those rare cases that we get in regard to entitlement to retirement benefits. A Ramsey County deputy sheriff who had served for 16 years went on medical leave unrelated to his job duties. The disability pension that he was awarded was different from the total amount which was requested by the sum of $500 a month. An administrative law judge concluded the sheriff's disability was directly related to his work and he should receive the higher line of duty benefits. The administrative agency disagreed, refused to pay. He ultimately appealed this matter to our court in December of 2004. The case was briefed and ready for scheduling in April of 2005. The oral arguments were held in September of 2005 with the decision ultimately in November of 2005. The Supreme Court appealed, the matter appealed to the Supreme Court was affirmed in December 7 of 2006. In our decision, we concluded that the employee, the sheriff, was entitled to the benefits as an inline duty officer. That ultimately appealed to the Supreme Court was affirmed. But I just want you to see the difference, the amount of time that it takes for some of these cases to go through the system, and the ultimate impact that delay has on the people who are either receiving benefits or alternatively having a redress of their grievances rectified. The purpose of our request is to try to reduce that time on appeal so that ultimately that we can comply with both our statutory and also our constitutional mandate.
Representative Eastland, do you have a question? That's okay. Mr. Shaw, did you agree? I was counting on you.
Yeah, let me think about it.
Okay. Anything else, Judge?
Oh, sir.
Okay. Representative Bowles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, I apologize for being late. I had a eye doctor appointment. I had some LASIK surgery just before session, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's looking to do it. It's great. But I wanted to thank Judge Toussaint and apologize to him for not being here. Mr. Chair, members, I have some unique perspective on the Court of Appeals. Right after graduating from law school, I spent a year clerking for Judge Joe Hallbrooks at the Court of Appeals, and I can speak personally to my experience there, and having talked with the chief and talked with other judges from the court, I fully understand and recognize and appreciate the not only the complexity and the importance of what the court is doing, but also, members, I would echo what the judge is saying about justice delayed is justice denied and the increased caseload at the Court of Appeals. I think if there's a way, Mr. Chair, that we can help address this, I think this is a really critical piece of the court's request. I don't want to downplay anything else that the courts are requesting, but speaking from some personal experience, I think this is really critical, and I look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, as we try to find a way to help the Court of Appeals fund their request. What I really think is a need. We got to take care of the courts, the co-equal branch of government, and this is something specific. It's something critical, and I hope that we're able to find a way to address it. And I appreciate it. Thank you,
Representative Close. I appreciate that, and hope that we can collectively figure this out. There is definitely a need. They need $36 million over the governor's recommendation, so we're going to have our work cut out for us, but. If we fund them, we have to take money from somewhere else, as you know, so we have some difficult questions ahead. Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, I agree, and I look forward to working with you. I had a similar conversation in committee with Chair Lincheski yesterday. I look forward to working with you as we work with your leadership to try to get a little bit bigger target for your committee.
There we go. All right. Mr. Stahl, do you want to proceed? Did you remember your question, Representative Eastman?
Great question, Mr. Chair. At the district level, we have this backlog, and at the Court of Appeals, we have the backlog. We need judges. Can you just tell us what is the impact of this kind of problem in the judicial system that's pushing things back? What's the impact of that on local community corrections and jails, and what's happening at the county level, and how that's affecting the cost that counties have to bear?
Mr.
Stahl.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland. You know, where there are delays, people are in jails longer, they're in out-of-home placement longer, all of these kinds of costs get pushed back, and the more that this happens, the more that this kind of impact is going to occur. So it kind of depends on the particular community. But I think what we wanted to show you here is behind these 2 million cases, there are people, your constituents are behind all of these are people with the most serious problems that they have. Nobody wants to be in court except for an adoption, I think that's what people say. And these are just very difficult and uncertain times for people, and the longer that persists, the bigger problems for those individuals, and that's what we wanted to deliver to you. And the backlog will create these, and has created these issues in local communities. But I think that we have shown, and science has shown that the swiftness with which we can impose a sentence and these sanctions in the criminal matters, which is the growth area that we have. That does have a real impact in trying to deal with this recidivism issue. Same thing we talked about with the drug courts. We're trying to get ahead of this problem and trying to deal with this constant growth at some point. We hope that we can make a dent here. And this is our contribution to this societal problem.
Representative Mulery, that brief question, we're going to move on because we have the tax court and legal aid still to do, and we have a bill up.
My statement's going to be shorter than your just was. I was just going to say that Representative Coles, I understand, is authoring your bill from a couple of years on income tax raising.
Somehow I doubt that. Mr. Stahl, do you have any other...
Thank you very much. We'll go on now to the next...
Judge, thank you very much for your testimony.
And I'd like to call on Judge Ed Lynch and Sandy Niren, who are going to come forward and speak to this next request.
Judge Lynch, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ed Lynch. I'm a judge in Dakota County in the 1st Judicial District. And I'm here to talk about what is the largest component of our budget request, the need to maintain core justice operations. It's the largest component of our budget request, and in my opinion, it's the most important, because it affects our greatest resource and our most valuable asset, the 3,000 employees of the judicial branch. This funding will be needed to pay negotiated wage and insurance increases for our employees that are, for the most part, determined by the executive branch, and to pay for increases in employer pension contributions that the legislature mandated last session. This request is not for any new positions. It is just to pay for and retain the employees we now have. It also includes a requested pay increase for judges that Sandy Nairn will talk about in a few minutes. Our need for well-trained, knowledgeable employees is driven by the volume of cases that are brought to the courts every day. As you know, we have no control over the number of cases that are filed, and we have no ability to restrict access to the courts. We are constitutionally obligated to hear all cases promptly and without delay. Our workload is dictated by law enforcement officers and prosecutors enforcing state and local laws, the desires of citizens and businesses to redress the needs of children, for redress and the needs of children and vulnerable adults for protection. Many of these cases are sensitive, emotionally charged matters. They may involve a criminal matter affecting a person's freedom. It may involve a domestic matter affecting a person's family. It may involve a civil matter affecting a person's property, but in all instances, they're affecting that person's future. These people deserve timely access, respectful treatment, fair hearings, and impartial decisions. Many of the 2 million cases that are disposed of each year are done with little, if any, involvement by judges, and they are done by our court administrative staff. These employees are the face of the justice system for most people coming to the court for services. I've said this before, and I've realized that it's even more true now than ever, that these people are not only the face of the justice system, they are the heart and soul of the justice system. They patiently explain complex processes of litigation, help people understand the unfamiliar, sometimes incomprehensible terms and the complicated procedures of the court. Empirical research shows that the perception of fairness is affected more by the way people are treated than the actual outcome of the case. Litigants and other court users in Minnesota have received timely, respectful, courteous treatment from our dedicated employees. And in a recent poll, 80% of respondents expressed confidence in the courts of the state of Minnesota. 2 years ago, I shared with this committee some stories about real-life experiences of our courts and staff, because it demonstrates the quality and the sensitivity and the caliber of the people that are working for us. I just want to share a few stories I've heard recently. One court administrator frequently brings home over the weekend the jury trial calendar for the following Monday so that she can contact and monitor settlements with attorneys so that she is able to call in only the bare minimum of jurors and inconvenience only the bare minimum of people to call them into court for jury service. Another court employee went out of her way and spent hours researching records back into the 1950s because a man came to her needing proof that he was a naturalized citizen. He even had to contact the Historical Society to get that verification, because he was turned away by other agencies and offices. And finally, let me relate the story I was told about the court employee who purchased with his own funds over his lunch hour a pet carrier. So a little boy who had been removed from an abusive mother in a child protection case and was being flown to Montana later that day to live with a father he hardly knew, to take with him his one constant friend, his cat. Our court administrators and staff are not just paperwork processors. They are the foundation of our justice system and one of the key reasons the citizens of this state have confidence in our courts. This budget request allows us to maintain this foundation, protect it from deterioration, and ensure its strength. I think Ms. Darren will talk about the request for judge to increase salary.
Mr. Chair, members of the division, my name is Sandy Nairn. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association. The District Judges Association is an association of the 281 trial court judges in the state. Many members of the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court also pay dues to this association. I just want to give you briefly some factors that you should take into consideration when deciding how to set judicial compensation, and that is part of the request in this budget. The typical lawyer who accepts an appointment to the bench has had about 18 years of experience in the private sector or the public sector before they accept an appointment. And the average judge that's now sitting on the bench has been there about 10 years. So in considering what compensation to set here, you are basically setting compensation for people who have 25 to 30 years of experience before in setting this compensation. Becoming a judge is a career decision. It's not a short-term employee to come in public sector like some others who come for a short period of time. It's usually an end-of-career decision, and once people accept appointments to the bench, they usually retire from that. So we are suggesting that maybe they should be treated as other full-time career state employees are. Judges only receive compensation increases when you grant them. They have no provision in law to give them across-the-board increases, step increases, merit increases. There's no formula in law at all that gives them anything unless you specifically authorize it. And included in your materials, I think, is a chart that was put together by the courts that shows you the increases given to judges over the last, I think, 35 years or so, as indicated on the chart. And as you can see, there's an erratic pattern. Legislature grants raises, then gives none for a period of time. I think during the 1990s, there was a 4.5-year stretch where they received no pay raises at all. Also attached is a chart that shows you the wages given to MAPE and AFSCME employees, two biggest unions in the state, shows you the across-the-board and step increases, step merit increases, and those are the average step merit increases given to those employees. Some received more than that. I do want to clarify that those employees, 100% of those employees, don't always receive those step merit increases. It's based upon years of service, and if they've reached the top, they don't receive it. But even if you weigh in that factor in calculating it, you'll see that those members of those unions do receive significantly higher percent increases to their pay as an average over the years compared to what judges receive. So it's something that we'd like you to consider here. Another factor that's commonly considered is a state-by-state comparison of how judges do compared to judges in other states. Historically, we've usually tried to stay in the high teens or certainly in the top half of the country in how we pay our judges. Because of the erratic pattern, unfortunately, by 2001, judges have fallen to 35th in the country, behind Alabama, behind Mississippi. So the legislature was very kind in 2001 and gave increases to bring judges back up to 18th in the country. It was a position that we were very content in staying, but again, the raises the last couple of years have caused us to fall back down to 24th by last year, and it appears as if we're falling even further. So we are moving in the opposite direction that we like. One other factor that this committee and the Compensation Council commonly considers in as a factor of deciding what to pay judges is private sector pay. Some of you may have seen the headline in the Minnesota Lawyer earlier this week. Pay for entry-level lawyers in the major firms in Minneapolis has now hit $120,000. That is almost identical to the pay for a district court judge who's had 30 years of experience. So this is what we're dealing with. I'm not suggesting that we try and keep up with this because we can't. But what was most surprising to me also in looking at some recent numbers was the growing disparity with judges and public sector lawyers. There's always been a number of elected county attorneys who have received higher pay than the district court, but there seems to be a growing disparity with that. A number of them are receiving significantly higher pay. Most interestingly, since you lifted or raised the cap on local government pay in general in 2005, we now have a fair number of assistant county attorneys who are also getting paid quite a bit more than the judges that they appear before. And for the first time, I've never seen this before, that we even have a number of sheriffs who are making more money than the district court judges. So I've never seen that that happen historically before at all. I do want to let you know that we should be very proud of the judiciary we have in Minnesota. Weighted caseload studies and others show that they work very hard. Legislative auditor did a report back in 2001 that showed that our judges in Minnesota handle 49% higher caseloads than judges in comparable states, so we know they work hard. U.S. Chamber does surveys every number of years on competence and integrity of the judiciary in every state in the country. Minnesota always ranks as one of the top states in that respect. And in talking with my colleagues and counterparts in the last 30 years that I've done work for the judiciary, I will tell you we are very, very fortunate to have the non-political judges that we have here who are very confident in what they do. The request of this budget is for a 5% pay raise over the next two Julys. It's higher than the request we made in 2005 when we were just asking for 3%. Because of budget constraints, then you weren't able to grant all of that. So we're trying to play a little catch-up here again and keep up. And lastly, I'd like to ask you to consider legislation that would basically put me out of a job. I'd like you to consider some legislation that would put into law a formula that would give judges increases automatically, possibly tied to what the other unions receive in the state or what other employees receive. A number of states have passed legislation like this that has formulas in law, and I have talked with Department of Employee Relations and others, and we certainly can come up with formulas that would give them more automatic increases. Legislature, of course, would still have the final say in whether or not you appropriated the money to pay those raises, but at least it would put some presumption into law that judges should be treated fairly and receive raises on a regular basis. We don't want big raises. We'd rather have small incremental raises. So that is our request, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Nairn. I do want to find out more about our ranking, because looking at the National Center for State Courts, they rank Minnesota fourth in the Midwest for current compensation for judges. So I'd be curious to know how we're 24th in the nation, but maybe by region it's different. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just very quickly, and it is about the compensation issue. I guess I want to know if any statistics are kept on the percentage of judges who leave the bench for higher paying employment. I know of one fairly well-known one who did just recently, but is that kind of data kept?
Mm-hmm. I think anecdotally there are a handful of judges who do leave the bench, go back to the private sector because of pay concerns. I don't think it's a real high percent, but it has happened. I think what probably more likely happens, Representative Biskins, is that they don't apply to begin with. And I think that's what the biggest concern is when you see the disparity with private sector pay is those people aren't applying to begin with. I have been told by people on the Merit Selection Commission that applications in the last number of years are down. There aren't as many people applying for these judgeships. Pay may be one factor. The growing politicalization of judicial races may be another one. It's hard to tell. But private sector employment, because they are compensated so well, is a deterrent to applications to begin with, and there is that growing disparity.
Representative Leshen and Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Nair, and I didn't think of this question until you held up that article about the top 20 firms. I guess it's top 20 firms of what they're starting their first year people at about 120 these days.
Yes.
I guess my question is, I started thinking about that, and I feel a little guilty asking this question because I am very supportive of making sure that the judges' salaries are commensurate when we get good judges in. But I thought of a couple of occasions where my cases get bumped due to judges being gone for conferences or vacation. And my first question is, do judges still get 6 weeks of vacation, or is that standard for all district court judges?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, yes, I think that is the...
Okay,
that is the policy, the court policy on vacation.
Representative Lesh.
And then just to follow up, I don't know what billable hours are generally required in these top 20 firms. I think Representative Coles probably knows, but he got out of that racket wisely. but my question is, has that considered in making sure that our salaries are commensurate? That may be what other states do as well. But has that been considered with respect to how we manage caseloads? I mean, I know that would very much be a sacred cow should judges get less vacation, but I find myself in the position once in a while as a trial attorney wishing they did once in a while. Has that ever been considered?
Ms. Nair?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, I'm not sure what the question is.
Representative Lesch, do you want to
rephrase it? Sure, sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Nguyen, will judges do with less vacation? That's my question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, vacation pay has been discussed by this committee and others over the years, and I will tell you that the 6 weeks vacation is not out of line with what other comparable long-term state employees get when they have served that long in public service. We're not talking about entry-level jobs with judges. Most of them, as I mentioned, transist from 20 years of practice and have been on the bench for 10 years. And if you compare that with the vacation given to state employees who've been around that long, it's not inconsistent.
Okay. Representative Cole.
I'm glad, Mr. Chair, that I don't have to appear in Ramsey County Court anytime soon after asking a question like that. Mr. Chair, Ms. Nguyen, the 24th in the nation ranking for judges' salaries, do you have information or could you or Mr. O'Sell provide us with information about how the Minnesota private marketplace compares to other states in terms of compensation for lawyers in the private sector? I'm sure that information exists somewhere. I don't know if you have it now or if you could provide it for us.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I don't have it now, but I'll be glad to try and find that out. It certainly makes a difference. And the 24th ranking, I do have that chart. I think I left a copy of it with you, Representative Paymar, when I met with you. That is the ranking from July of 06, and I think it's gone down since then.
Thank you, Ms. Nguyen. Judge Lynch, thank you for your testimony. What we're going to do now, Mr. Beneke has been so kind to have his testimony on legal aid another day. I think what I'd like to do, Mr. Saul, we didn't really hear about guardian ad litems, and I don't know if members had questions. We could schedule a separate time for that, but I did want Judge Perez to review the tax court budget. But
just one note about one other request.
Oh, your security.
We'll take about 1 second, and that has to do with security funding for the Minnesota Judicial Center. We have recently had the National Guard Reserve do a comprehensive review of security issues on the whole Capitol Mall. I believe there's some funding in the Department of Public Safety request for that. This is their recommendation for the judicial branch, which would provide for a weapon screening and one armed trooper and two unarmed Capitol security guards to manage that. The problem is that we right now have one unarmed Capitol security guard handling multiple entrances and five courtrooms that are going in at any one time, and it really there is no security. So that's what the request is. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Starr.
Members of the committee.
We may have you back again, but thank you all for your testimony. Judge Perez, do you want to provide an overview of your budget request?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members.
You have
to yield more time to the judicial branch if they so
need. Yeah. Judge, just if you could finish, could you do this in maybe 10 minutes, your presentation?
Yes.
Okay.
My name is George Perez. I'm the Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court, and just a very brief overview. I know some of you are familiar with the tax court, so I'll just be very brief. It's a court that is... It's a court that consists of three full-time judges and three staff. We hear two types of cases. We hear property tax appeals that come directly from the counties. That accounts about 70% of our caseload. And then the other 30% is made up from what we call the Department of Revenue Commissioner cases that come directly from the commissioner. That involves sales and income tax cases primarily. The tax court was established by this body as a full-time court in 1978, and it serves the needs primarily of the everyday taxpayers in the state of Minnesota. About 70% of our litigants comprise the everyday taxpayers, maybe another 20% comprise small businesses, small business owners, and maybe less than 10% comprise larger companies and firms that appear before the tax court. Our budget consistently has been one that we never ask for anything more or anything less. It's been pretty stable throughout the years. Our costs are those that reflect mandated statutory requirements, such as salaries, travel. We, like the Minnesota Court of Appeals, we travel to all 87 counties. We go where the taxpayer is resides, where the property resides. They do have an option to come to St. Paul, but in most cases they opt to stay in their respective home county. The governor has requested a 1.6 total budget, which we are in favor of and agree with wholeheartedly. And with that, I'll conclude if there's any further questions, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Judge, how are we doing on the law clerk?
Well, we are still the only court in the state of Minnesota that does not have a law clerk. And I note that there was a member of your body here who has served as a law clerk. And so I think that individual would understand that for a court not to have any law clerks, the additional burden that puts on the judges who have to do everything from scratch in terms of research and writing and hearing the cases and keeping up with the increasing caseload. So we didn't ask for one in the last biennium. We had requested one in the previous one. That request was denied. So in this one, we decided to just go back to asking for our budget without requesting that one additional law clerk. But it's certainly something that we need and we could put to use. We do have interns that come in, but again, as the member of this body knows, that unless you're there for about a year, 2 years, that's when you really become proficient at what you do. We have interns that come and go on a one-semester basis. We're happy to have them, but they're there for about 3 months, and by the time they're beginning to learn something, they have to go back to school and finish their studies.
Representative Murphy.
Point taken, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Judge Perez, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
Members, this time we'll have about 12 minutes here. We'll hear, we're going to hear one bill, House File 303, and if we can't finish it today, we'll finish it up tomorrow if there's questions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymar, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to move House File 303, and I would ask the Chair to, after testimony, lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
We will do so. You may proceed.
Briefly, Mr. Chair and members, the Youth Intervention Project, most of you know the work of this VIPA. Is a crime prevention and early intervention program that provides early intervention services to kids in order to keep them out of further involvement with the criminal justice system and to help them to become productive members of society. The program just last year provided intervention services to over 18,000 young people. The state and the youth intervention program communities have partnered for over 30 years providing early youth intervention services. For every dollar that the state provides, the $2 must be raised and matched from the community. The Youth Intervention Project works with kids that are at a crossroads between choosing behaviors or choosing criminal behaviors or choosing positive behaviors. We think that the kinds of programs all throughout the state keep kids in schools and keeps them on the positive path. The Youth Intervention Program is asking for House File 303, $4 million over the biennium. If we can find the money, members, to do this, we will be able to add 35 to 40 programs throughout the state. I think you have a map in your packet that shows some of the areas that are not, where there's not programming, that we could provide programming. And this would be $4 million to their base budget. And with that, I will turn the presentation over to Scott Beatty, and we have also a few testifiers.
Welcome, Mr. Beatty.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks a lot. I'm not going to talk very long because I know we only have a few minutes, and I think there's other people here that I really would like to talk about some of their experiences with this program. But I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Youth Intervention Programs Association, and I represent approximately 60 early intervention programs from around the state, and I'm also here to advocate for the youth intervention program today. As Representative Paymar said, youth intervention is an early intervention program, meaning it works with kids that are just starting to get in trouble. That could be legal, it could be school, it could be truancy, it could be drug use, those kind of things. But the whole idea is to get these kids early and to keep them out of further involvement in the juvenile justice system. The current funding is $1,652,000, and that currently provides funding to 54 community-based agencies. And in your packet, the Office of Juvenile Justice Programs at the Department of Public Safety have put together a little handout that shows the amounts that these programs are getting. These are the state amounts. As Representative Paymar mentioned, they also are required to come up with $2 in community funding, so these dollars are very well leveraged. The one thing I did want to say is this program received a 27% cut back in 2003 when the state had to balance the budget, that $4.5 billion budget. And since that time, we estimate that probably about 18,000 kids have not received early intervention programs because of this. What happened is a lot of staff layoffs, a lot of program cuts, those sort of things happen. So I guess the question is what really happened to those kids? Well, I can tell you, and I think my next speaker, Dakota County Attorney Jim Backstrom, could also tell you that what's happening is the crime rate for youth crime rate has also increased. And I really do think that's a direct result of the cuts that happened to youth programs. And so I think the time is really right for these programs to have an investment from the state in here. I just think the time is right and it's critical. So I'm going to stop my speech here and hand it over to...
All right, before calling on Mr. Backstrom, Representative Eastland, did you have a question?
I have a question to the bill more.
Okay. You may proceed, Mr. Backstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm James Backstrom, Dakota County Attorney, and it's nice to be back here for the second day in a row to testify before you. In my 20 years as county attorney, I've seen a lot of growth in crime and just remarkable growth in juvenile crime during the 1980s and through the mid-1990s. And while that growth has leveled off somewhat both in my community and in our nation, and in fact has dropped in the juvenile area in recent years, we still have tremendously more juvenile crime today than we had two decades ago in our state and in our nation. And I have also come to believe that the most important thing we can do to reduce crime among our youth in this country is early intervention and prevention efforts. I spend a great deal of resource and time in my office doing just that with multiple programs that I have that include truancy intervention, a bully intervention program that we sponsor, multiple crime prevention programs, and I am a solid partner with Scott Beatty, his organization, and others like it in our state that invest resources, time, and energy in young people. It is truly the most important investment we can make if we want to keep our communities safe, reduce crime among our children, and we need to make those investments now before it's too late. Kids today have access to an enormous amount of material that is disturbing, quite frankly. You know, the levels of violence that young people are brought up with today is alarming. And we are really at a critical point in terms of making sure that we have enough programs in place to make these kids understand right from wrong and respect for one another and respect for our laws. And having a mentor, a youth mentor, having after-school programming, having places where these kids can go to do some constructive things instead of getting into trouble with the law and experimenting with alcohol and drugs, as I was here talking to you about yesterday with the enormous problems with those substances and the access to kids today. We need to do everything we possibly can to make sure that every at-risk child in our country has access to these types of programming efforts. And the youth intervention programs do a remarkable service. Unfortunately, they don't have enough resources to meet the need. And that's what they're here for today, to ask you to support. And I just wanted you to know, from a prosecutor who's tough on crime, I think we also need to be smart on crime and invest our resources up front if we want to keep our community safer in the long run. So thank you for allowing me to be here to support this important program.
Before calling on any questions, I believe there's a youth here that set to testify. I would like them to come forward at this stage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll have a couple other folks come up. Thank you.
Okay, when you're about to speak, would each one of you please give your name?
My name is Perry Lopkins.
Why don't you proceed, Mr.
I have just two small short stories to tell you. There are two different families. The first family I know, their parents got divorced. The mother moved 200 miles away from the father. Saw him every other weekend, the kids, on holidays and when they could in the summer. That happened until they were about 15 years old, when these kids were into sports, into school, into their friends, and that kind of faded away. The first time that one of these sons got involved with alcohol, he was 17 years old, and he was brought home by the police. Nothing else happened. The second time, he was 17, and this time he went to court. And there really wasn't a lot the court could do, so the judge lectured him and told him he didn't want to see him in his courtroom again and let him go. The third offense, he was 18 now, a senior in high school, and got another alcohol offense. He went to court this time as an adult, and the judge asked him, have you ever been involved with alcohol before as a adult? He said no. He was fined $120, sent on his way again. The fourth time he came in, 2 weeks before graduation, another offense. It was 18. This time, him and his best friend were out drinking. They drove a car. He rolled that car. He was airlifted to Duluth, maybe paralyzed. His best friend lay dead on the side of the road. He had 4 felony counts of homicide against him, jail, treatment, drug and alcohol testing, probation, counseling, all those things that probably should have happened way long ago. He's now 21, trying to figure out his life, can't get a job because of the felony on his record, and that family deals with that every day. The other story, same thing happened. Divorce, kids moved away, but this time, on that first offense, the court said there was an early intervention program in that community. They sent that child to that on the first offense. He received counseling, some alcohol awareness classes. He was sent with a mentor who set him up for a year, talked to him about schooling, what his goals were, set him on the right track. At 18, he graduated high school. Now he's 21, he's in college, he's working, he's becoming a productive citizen, and he's thinking of mentoring himself. The difference between these two stories is one is true and one isn't. The first one's true. It's my son. And we still fight with that every single day of that incident. The second story could be true. If we had more of these kind of interventions around the state and in every community where people could access them. I don't believe this is a parenting issue. I don't feel that I'm a bad parent. I don't feel that my ex-wife is a bad parent. We used the resources that we had available at that time to us, and it just didn't work. We hope that at some point in time the state of Minnesota will have those kind of resources everywhere in every community so they don't have to go through the things that our family went through. Thanks.
Thank you. Would you proceed?
My name is Trey.
Go ahead, Trey.
How I started in the program, I was,
Would you state your last name, too, Trey?
Trey Patterson. How I started in the program, I was doing pretty bad at school. A little bit in the middle, I was doing okay. And the school social worker advised me that I need to go through this program. I said I'd give it a try. And from then on, I've been doing stuff that I wouldn't be doing if I wasn't in the program. That's what we do is bike, exercise, put down goals to do, like how to stay in school, keep my grades up. Everything's been going straight from then, but
My name is Mark Krinke. I'm Trey's mentor. I've been working with Trey since August of last year. We're in a biking program. Trey's done three bike rides now between 15 and 30 miles, which is tough. I'm a biker. It's easier for me. But Trey, even when he's sick, has done them. We volunteered at a bunch of different things. We work on his grades. We set goals. We just hang out. We play video games. And we talk about what Trey needs to do to keep in school. He's getting his grades up. He's not been truant. Trey's actually a really good kid. Got kind of a chaotic home life, but we just hang out and keep Trey on track and talk about the things he has to do.
Mr. Patterson, you're doing great. At your age, I wouldn't be here testifying. I wouldn't have been here testifying. So, if you have any comments, how you'd like to add?
No.
My name's Daryl Thompson. I'm the director of Boulder Options, the program that Trey and his mentor are in. And I just want to thank you for taking a few minutes to listen to me. And I heard one of the members earlier mention that she wanted to try to figure out what it was that they could do about crime, because I've been here for about an hour, and I noticed that our system is swelling with people that are involved in the system. And we've been doing this. I've been the executive director for 13 years at Boulder Options, and I've seen how they have, you know, cut and changed things, and I noticed that the court system's changing, and I know people don't have an opportunity to take advantage of programs like ours, and we're here, and hopefully you guys will realize that some funding programs like ours and youth intervention programs across the state makes a difference, because someone like Trey or kids that don't get an opportunity like Trey or even Perry's son, it makes a big difference, and it costs millions and millions of dollars. Just one person can cost that, and there's all types of studies that kind of prove those facts. So thank you very much, and we hope that we get the funding.
Unless somebody has a specific question among the representatives that have questions.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say, and then we can open it up, or we can, if there are a lot of questions, we can take up the matter again tomorrow morning. But I did want to say that this additional money would, as I said earlier, would provide, we can create 35 to 40 new programs throughout the state and increase the existing grants up to $50,000 for YIPA programs that already exist. So I don't know how many questions there are. If members are willing to stay a little longer, maybe we can finish the bill. But
there's five representatives with questions so far, so I think we better, unless they have a specific question for one of the speakers. Representative Zellers has one for one of the testimonies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Trey, you're doing a great job, son. Thanks for coming in. I'm with Chairman Owen. I don't think I could have done it at your age. This is, and don't feel that you need to answer, maybe Trey, your mentor, can ask. Talk about, I know the bravery he's exhibiting by doing some of this, the peer pressure that he's probably under, maybe in school or in some of the folks, some of the kids that led down this path, maybe as a mentor you can tell a little bit more about how brave he is and how courageous he is to make this the change back and to do some of these things, some of the things that Trey's under, not only in his home life, but in school.
Yeah, certainly. You know, and actually, it's, when you talk about peer pressure, it's interesting that Trey's friends all asked about joining the program because they've heard about how great it is, how much fun we have. They want to go on bike rides with us. They all want to know how to get the applications and join in. And these might not even be kids that are having any problems. But, you know, Trey, when I first met him, he didn't have much to say. He didn't really look at me. I didn't really feel like we were going to really hit it off. But since then, Trey's kind of quiet now, but he's not amongst the two of us at all. I call him up and I say, do you want to do something? He says, yeah, tomorrow. He wants to do things. He wants to talk about goals. He wants to get his grades up. If Trey gets his grades up and is not truant, he actually gets a new bike at the end of the program. And he didn't want to talk about school at all until we talked about that bike. And now that's all he wants to talk about. He wants the bike. He wants to get his grades up. And it's really motivated him. And we sat down at a restaurant on Saturday after a spin class. We did a spin class at the Y. And we went through all the goals. And Trey's got plans for college or for going to school. He wants to be a professional gamer. We also have a plan B just in case that doesn't work out. But Trey, he wants to make things work. And he wants to stay out of trouble. And he makes it very clear. And you know, he's one of the many kids in there that he's actually, I feel, one of the easier kids in all the class, because Trey and I don't have problems. Trey's, you know, you can tell he's a nice kid. He's very, very nice to everybody. Trey doesn't swear at all, which is amazing for a kid this age. I have to watch myself because they'll slip out once in a while. But, you know, he wants to do the right thing. He just wants a little bit of help, and it's easy for me. I don't have much to do. I just have to hang out with him and learn a lot from him.
I believe Representative Lesh's question was directed to him.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, briefly, also, Trey, to you, thanks a lot for coming in. Yeah, I don't think any of us would have come in here and testified at your age at all either. And I myself had a few problems in school myself. I got in a little trouble. There's some people around here would say I still get in trouble. But now I have a law degree and, you know, so that's right. So that's helpful. But so thanks a lot for coming in and talk to us. It makes a big difference when you come in and tell your story. And Mr. Thompson, also I want to tell you, you know, it hasn't gone unnoticed, Boulder Options on the east side of St. Paul, too. It's my district. Thanks a lot for coming there. It makes a lot of difference for the youth. And I've had people talk to me about that, so I just wanted to issue a thank you on that front. So that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Maybe we'll just keep going for a couple of minutes. Representative Eastland.
My question had to do with the bill to the author, and maybe it's just an oversight, maybe it's in there, but the language in the bill specifically said, and I put it away here, but it was on line, sorry about that. It was on line 9. It says the commissioner uses money to make grants to help existing programs, but we're talking about new programs as well. I'm just wondering if a friendly amendment would be to put new or existing.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mr. Paymer.
Representative Eastland, I think that's a good point. I was totally an oversight because this is creating some new programs and upping their grants. So, members, I would move on line 9 after programs, insert the words.
New or before existing would work.
Before existing or new, I would move
that. Is there any discussion on that? If not, let's just vote on the amendment.
Can you restate the amendment?
The amendment reads, on line 9, the commissioner must use this money to make grants to help new or existing programs. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I think it should be existing or new. I think the first priority should be to the existing programs.
If unless there's an objection, we'll change it to existing or new. all in favor of the amendment so we can just proceed with the amendment?
No.
No. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this might be an appropriate place to bring this up because Mr. Chairman, I understand what you're trying to do, and I'm ready to vote in favor of it. However, there is a huge policy change in the way this is written. All right, Mr. Chairman, I went back to Section 299.73, and the verbiage there says the Commissioner may make grants to nonprofit agencies administering youth intervention programs. But clearly, as you read the sentence that starts on line 1.9 and continues on to 1.11, this not only allows the Commissioner to dole out the grants, but in specific in 1.10, this now would allow the Commissioner to actually create the programs. And so that's a big policy shift, right? Where now the agency would be creating the programs rather than letting the nonprofits make the proposals, right? This would allow the Commissioner to create the programs, and I'm not quite sure you wanted to go down that road.
Mr. Beatty has Mr. Chairman.
Representative Paymer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Biskins, I think the idea with this language was to, there's probably nonprofits out there or school districts or police departments or court services that are currently doing these kind of programs that could use some of this money. The other thing is that there may be communities that don't have any of these programs in existence, so the idea was that they might be able to come up with a new program on their own. So that's the idea with the create, that there might be programs that would be funded through it, and there might be programs that actually get created in communities that don't have anything.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and so I understand your intent, but the problem is that the verbiage says that an agency could create.
At this stage, what I'm going to recommend is that we continue this discussion tomorrow morning at first thing, because we're going to go well past now. And with that, I will adjourn the meeting.